From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Golhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro won a second term on May 20th in a vote that has been widely criticized in the Western media. Mr. Maduro, who was seen as a political successor to the late charismatic socialist president Hugo Chavez, drew nearly 70% of votes in an election where turnout was low compared to earlier elections. Anti-government forces had called for an election boycott in the lead-up to the vote, and the U.S. had slammed the election as unfair even before it took place. It has now threatened to slap Venezuela with stronger sanctions. Venezuela's economy has been struggling for years, in part due to a lull in global oil prices. My guest is Kevin Zeese. He is co-director of Popular Resistance. He traveled to Venezuela for the recent presidential elections and wrote about it on his return. Welcome to the program, Kevin.
Thanks for having me on.
So if you just go by Western media coverage, you imagine government forces and the military at, you know, gunpoint forcing people to choose Maduro. What indeed happened in reality on the ground? What did you notice about the election while you were there?
Well, the people who supported the Chavistas, the President Maduro, turned out. They know that they are in an economic war with the United States. The U.S. is doing its best to strangle the economy, and it's having a major impact on food and medicine and other shortages. And the people are saying we're not going to be pressured by the United States and Western governments to reject independence from the U.S. empire. That's what this is about. And the people stood up and gave Maduro a positive response, and now he has the authority to move forward and try to build an independent economy, a much-needed independent economy.
And that's a big part of what I want to get to. But staying on the election, the two opposition candidates who ran against him, Andre Falcon and Javier Bertucci, did they want to have people turn out to vote for them, but there were others who called for a boycott?
Well, the conservative coalition, MUD, called for a boycott. Henry Falcon was threatened by the United States with sanctions if he ran. So the U.S. was pressuring him not to run, but he ran anyway. And he said he would support the result of the election before the result came in. After it came in, he changed his mind and said he didn't support the election result. They did their best to overcome the boycott, but there were a lot of pressure on a boycott. There were protests in some of the wealthier parts of Caracas trying to keep people away from the polls. And I think they succeeded pretty well in doing that. In addition to people boycotting from the oligarch side, from the U.S. side, people who support Maduro didn't bother to vote sometimes because they said, well, we know it's going to turn out. Only one side's turning out. So we talked to a number of people who were Maduro supporters who didn't turn out. So there was a low turnout because of that boycott. And as much as Falcon tried, he couldn't succeed. I think part of the problem for Falcon was he had to basically give in the United States agenda. He wanted to dollarize the economy, make the dollar, the U.S. U.S. dollar, the currency used. And he also wanted to get loans from IMF and Western bankers. People who know that when you take loans from IMF and Western bankers, they tend to dictate your policy. They dictate policies that cut social safety net and funnel money to the investors, to the bankers and oligarchs in the country. So he took a pro-U.S. position, which I think was exactly the wrong position at a time when the U.S. is being very aggressive in its economic war against Venezuela.
Now, just going back to your point about the low turnout, 46% still turned out to vote, which compared to the United States is a very good turnout.
Yeah, no, it's better than Switzerland. Switzerland always does worse. Chile does worse. So it's not that out of line, and it's very equivalent to the United States national elections, much higher than local, state, and local elections in the United States. But typically, they would have an 80% turnout. I think that the opposition, which I mean by that, the United States and the Venezuelan wealthy people, saw two choices. One, run and lose, because the popularity of Maduro and the Bolivarian Revolution is very high. People see them really trying to help them in their lives. Run and lose, or boycott and try to undermine the credibility of the election. They chose the boycott undermine approach, and they're still trying to undermine the credibility of the election now. But that was their choice. They're going to lose either way, so why don't we just say elections are fake and a fraud, when in fact, the electoral system in Venezuela is the best electoral system in the world. There's no question about it. Even Jimmy Carter said that when he looked at the electoral system in Venezuela. It's really well run, very well managed. Unlike the United States, where one party tries to suppress voter turnout, in Venezuela, voting is a constitutional right. As a result, they have many polling places, so it's much easier to go to vote. And they hold elections on a weekend, not on a work day. So they try to make it easy to vote. And so it's a very different environment than the United States. Venezuela really takes democracy seriously. I'd call it a deep democracy. It's amazing when I hear President Trump and others calling it a dictatorship or calling for a coup by the military to restore democracy. It's just such nonsense, so out of touch with the reality of what's on the ground in Venezuela. I'll just give one example about their electoral system. They require a 53% audit of the machines on election day. That means that they take the election machine results, the electronic results, and compare it to a voter-verified paper record. Each voter gets a record, puts it in the ballot box, and at the end of the day, 53% are counted and compared to the machine results. No other country does an audit like that.
Wow.
That's a very serious undertaking.
I mean, here in the United States, where we've got this terrible patchwork of state-by-state voting systems, and, you know, where our president lost the popular vote, certainly doesn't seem to be... have much leg to stand on to criticize what happened in Venezuela. What then is the basis of the claims by fraud that you see in so many Western news pieces covering the election? Even sort of if you look at the details, you see a lot of claims about a lot of mentions of fraud, saying that they were claims of fraud. So if you look at the detail of these articles, they may not be saying that fraud happened, but they're saying that someone said that fraud happened. What's that based on?
It's total falsehood. In fact, fraud, voting fraud is impossible in the electoral system. They do something that we would never do in the United States. But what they do is they require a fingerprint when you register to vote and require that fingerprint be used to start the voting process. The machine will not turn on unless you provide a fingerprint. And then when you're done voting, you provide a second fingerprint to stop to show you did vote. So there's a fingerprint record of the person who voted, and the machines won't start without that fingerprint. So you can't have fraud. It's just not even possible. It's totally an effort to undermine the legitimacy of a very legitimate government, a government that has the support of the people. Venezuela is a threat to the United States, a threat because it's an example of a country saying, no, we will not be submit to U.S. empire. We will not be giving our oil profits to U.S. oil companies. We're going to share that oil wealth with the people to lift them out of poverty, teach them to read and write.
So
it's a very different situation.
Let's just take one news outlet and how it is claiming that the election might have been fraudulent. NPR, in an article entitled Venezuela's Maduro Wins Boycotted Elections Amid Charges of Fraud, in that piece it says, those opposed to Maduro have long maintained that the election is fraudulent, not least because the opposition's most popular leaders, the ones with the best chances of unseating the president, were barred from running. How do you respond to that?
Well, they are barred for good reason. One of those leaders was involved in the very violent revolts and called for a regime change, called for a coup. That would be called terrorism in the United States. You're going to let someone like that run for president? That's kind of hard to imagine, even allowed. The other was barred because of financial irregularities in his previous campaign. Violating election finance laws. Henry Falcone was the campaign manager for one of those two candidates. So it's not like they barred, and he was a former governor. He's a legitimate candidate. So they didn't bar legitimate candidates. They just barred criminals. And I think that in the United States, you'd see those same kind of people barred here.
So let's now talk about what needs to happen in Venezuela. There is a real disaffection with the government because of the very real issue of the economy struggling, very deeply struggling. There have been a lot of Venezuelans who, you know, while they accept the Bolivarian revolution's pro-people position, you still have to have an economy that does function, and there's been widespread inflation. What is your assessment of why Venezuela's economy has been failing, and what Maduro could do to revive this economy now that he has been reelected?
Right, great question. Well, Venezuela has a number of problems, some of its own structural problems of its own, and some is the outside interference of the United States. The big structural problem, which has existed for about 100 years now, is that it's an oil-based economy, and that's the major source of revenue for the economy. When the oil became, Venezuela has the largest oil reserves in the world, so that's understandably why that's happened. When Venezuela became an oil-based economy, a lot of people moved in from the rural areas into the cities. That undermined their agricultural economy, which has not really recovered from that. When Chavez came to power, he tried to correct this 100-year reliance on oil by creating new segments, sectors in the economy. He tried, but he didn't succeed in doing enough of that. Then the oil price fell from 140 a barrel down to 30 or 40 a barrel. It's back up to 60 or 70. And so when that drop in oil prices fell, that just really undermined the economy. Then on top of that, since the 2002 coup against Chavez that the United States supported, when that coup was defeated, they initially removed Chavez, but within a day, the people revolted against the coup and he was brought back to power. Since then, the U.S. has been taking the approach they took in Chile. Make the economy scream. Make the economy scream so people are angry at the government and are willing to vote it out, replace it. Hmm. President Obama, for example, declared that Venezuela was a national security threat. That allowed the U.S. to put in place sanctions. Those sanctions have grown more and more tight, more and more difficult. It's cut off food and medicine. It's cut off international financial lending. And so that's been a major problem for getting out. Now, Maduro has the chance now to take this on again, and he's trying. Even during this financial crisis, they've continued to focus on trying to solve the problems of the poorest Venezuelans. And Venezuela has a large poor population, not because of the Chavez-Maduro policies, but because of a long-term reality of oligarchy, where all the money went to a very small percentage of people, and everyone else literally was in poverty and unable to read and write or get health care or even have housing. Even during this economic crisis, Maduro was very proud to achieve 2 million new homes built for the poorest Venezuelans. 2 million. Each home holds four or so people. That's 8 million people getting new homes in the midst of an economic crisis. The population of Venezuela is 32 million. So 8 million people get new homes during this economic crisis out of a population of 32. That's pretty phenomenal. Think of that compared to how we've treated Puerto Rico in a year since the hurricane. They're still struggling and facing new hurricanes. Think of how our urban areas have tens of thousands of abandoned homes and thousands of people homeless. Compare that to what Venezuela is doing in the midst of an economic crisis. There are serious problems, though. And so I think that Maduro needs to do a few things. One, he needs to continue to try to build an independent domestic economy, really encouraging gardening at all levels from urban to rural to try to create their own food supply.
So it's sort of food sovereignty.
Mm-hmm. That's what they call it. They call it food sovereignty. Sovereignty from big business, from GMO foods, from Monsanto, from a pesticide-based food supply that dominates the world. They want to break from that. Second thing is they need to continue to build their relationship. So that's one aspect of multiple fronts. They need to build their domestic economy. They need to keep focusing on that. The cooperative efforts that they have in Venezuela are very significant. Continue to allow local communities to develop systems of food distribution and also help develop their own needs in their communities. That's what I mean by being a hyper-democratic country. Local communities are doing participatory democracy, where they get together in assemblies come together and decide what their community needs, and they seek the money from their local state or federal government. It's pretty an amazing process. Keep
you call them
that.
They're called communal councils, which you write about in your article. I mean, almost sort of like our city councils, but people might actually show up to the meetings.
The only difference with our city council is the city council is representative democracy.
Right.
The councils are participatory democracy.
Right. So it's not that they're elected representatives that meet and then people view them as spectators and sometimes get to speak for a few minutes. This is people who show up get to have a say.
That's right. That's right. Like in Oakland, I remember seeing arrests in Oakland where people spoke longer than 2 minutes. They were threatened with arrest, and some people were arrested for speaking longer than 2 minutes at the city council meeting. Just absurd. And we call that democracy. The other thing is that there's a real drive against U.S. empire worldwide, moving away from this unipolar world to a multipolar world. And China and Russia are two of the key players in that. There are other countries as well. But China and Russia were two of the first countries to congratulate Maduro on his victory. Unlike the United States, they recognized the democracy had occurred and that it deserved support.
And so the U.S. has basically not recognized the election results. What does this mean, for U.S.-Venezuela relations? To not recognize the results of a presidential election by the United States is a serious thing.
And the worst thing about that is they said they were not going to recognize it before the vote even occurred.
Right.
They even know how it turned out, they're not going to accept it. It was just a bizarre anti-democracy view by the United States. And the United States, Secretary Tillerson, Senator Rubio, Donald Trump have been calling for a military coup to restore democracy. Just think of that, a coup to restore democracy in one of the most democratic countries on earth. It's just absurd. And Trump keeps saying the military is options on the table. Our Southern Command leader is meeting with the leaders and other leaders of U.S. allies in Colombia, allegedly planning a military attack. So there's a lot of threats around Venezuela from the United States, and not recognizing the democratic vote is part of justifying that threat. It's a lie, and I think my big takeaway for people in the United States is, when I'm coming back from Venezuela, is you are being lied to by our media and by our politicians, as well as some groups like Human Rights Watch, which has a terrible record on Venezuela. But the truth is out there. You can find the truth. There are, foreign news sources, independent news sources that report on the truth. We need to undermine the lies and demand an end to the economic war, demand an end to economic sanctions, and stop trying to dominate this independent nation of Venezuela. Let them be sovereign. Let them decide their future. Let them create a new type of economy. It might be something we can learn from. We can learn from their community councils. We can learn about deep democracy. That would be a great thing to apply to U.S. cities, which feel very underrepresented. We get 10% turnout in many city elections because they feel so unrepresented by their elected officials. We need to really reinvigorate democracy in the United States, and we could learn from Venezuela about that.
Well, Kevin, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We will link to your article in Popular Resistance. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. Appreciate you letting people hear this viewpoint.
Kevin Zeese is co-director of Popular Resistance. He traveled to Venezuela for the recent presidential election. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.